Hi, everybody. My name is Barry Essen, a member of ARICA. Fred, are you on the phone? Carry on. I was trying to think. It's really great to see you all here tonight. Thanks for coming. Trying to think about what would be a good introduction. The best introductions that I've ever seen to things are where people are made to feel comfortable but also alert. I'll probably fail at both of those things, but I will try, I suppose. For those of you that haven't been to our events before, or for those of you that have and are confused, or if we've never managed to get this across, I suppose I think our events are supposed to be to celebrate and explore our desires and struggles in creating our lives and worlds together. I think that involves aesthetics, but also politics. I hope that these events somehow address the kind of intertwined nature of our everyday lives and our politics and our art forms. I guess I should, in this situation, I'm kind of making a set of invitations to all of you to join the conversations that we've already been having, and to, I suppose, we're acknowledging some of the contradictions of what's happening in those conversations and what it means to be in this space here and now, but to over the course of this weekend, join in a kind of an exploration of some of the themes and things that we've been thinking about. A lot of over the last couple of years, we've been spending a lot of time in America, and a lot of the friends and allies that we've made from America are here with us this evening. And we try and work always through friendship and solidarity and through introductions and just slowly getting to know people and deepen conversations that we're having. So I suppose that's very slow. Sometimes it feels slow, and it also feels like you know, sometimes we come back to the same themes, or we invite the same people back, or we're having the same kind of conversations. You might recognize a few faces if you've been to previous events. But I think in being so interested in some of the allies and friends that we've made in America, I think that it's important to say that we're not inviting people over here to be some kind of exotic exemplar of a foreign culture or something. I think what we're trying to think about is that in the conversations that we've had recently, how our desires and struggles are similar to the desires and struggles of people that we've met, how some of the issues that they face and the situations that they struggle against are the same but also different from what we face here. So although this weekend is very much exploring the kind of false ideas, the imposed kind of norm, like there's no such thing as a norm. Nobody embodies a norm. There's no one person that this example of a normal person or something. But as much as this weekend might talk about ideas of race and sex and gender, then in the ways in which people express their desires and struggle against the oppressions of that, they also reveal, we also in this country struggle against and are oppressed, labor under many of these oppressions, and they translate or they map onto the ways in which our society is riven by other imposed and brutally policed norms of class, of religion, as well as, you know, race and sex and stuff. So I guess I hope this weekend will be a way of us kind of talking about those similarities and those differences. And I think we always talk about going into these things radically not knowing what we're kind of, each of these episodes is because we don't know about a bunch of stuff. So I don't think we're proposing any kind of answers or anything. I'm just interested in what we can find out together. With that in mind, I think that what am I going to say? I guess I think that maybe this weekend, so the way that this weekend might work is that we would I think that the events this evening, as well as being in and of themselves, they're also kind of like an introduction to the conversations that we've already been having, or the ways in which we've been dancing together, or the things that we've been listening to, or the places that we spend our time together. And then over the course of the weekend, I hope that many of you can join in with those conversations and help us explore these ideas more fully. And to that end, I guess this is a slightly odd setup that we've come up with. But I suppose the idea with this table in the middle is that it will be both a table, a table around which we can all have these discussions and explore these ideas, but also a site upon which we can engage in the kind of like aesthetic registers of thinking. We can listen to music, we can dance, we can see people dancing. We're also going to watch some films for which we've got a very fancy big screen that will appear magically above us when we move to another space. But I suppose, even though I certainly don't believe in parliamentary democracy, and I'm very suspicious of many forms of democracy, so I'm not saying this is some kind of democratic thing where you can do what you like, this false idea of like you can choose, you know, I would like to be free of many choices rather than have to constantly choose who's going to do my dentistry or something, like, I don't know. So although many of the people around the table have been invited to this weekend already, we would like you and the audience to feel comfortable to sit at this table. We've also invited over the course of the weekend many of our allies and friends in Glasgow to also sit at the table. People aren't under any pressure to speak or say anything, but I think it's nice, just as much as any structure that you impose is always problematic. But it's we're trying at least to sit together and talk together and listen together. If you come to the club tonight, maybe we can dance together. I'm dancing with Reina. I'm not, actually, I'm a really terrible, terrible dancer. So the first thing that I would like to do is invite Sadia Hartman to talk to us about the her ideas of waywardness. I hope that in that kind of her beautiful, what did we call it before in the past? I think you laughed at it, like socio-poetic cultural history or something. I was trying, and I think Sadia thought that was silly or something. But like, I'd invite you to listen and think alongside Sadia, and for that to be a way in which we get into the evening, into the weekend, and then we can go outside, get a drink, and go upstairs and watch Killer of Sheep and meet some of the other people we've been having conversations with. And then I hope also go and dance. So thanks very much for coming. I hope you're here for many things over the weekend, and I'll hand you over to Sadia.
So it's very wonderful to be here with so many people I respect whose work has been so important to my own. So I'm going to begin. This is thinking about making a way out of no way, thinking about an earlier moment. It's from a book that's actually about the formation of the ghetto, which was another moment, of kind of lockdown for Black people in the state. So it's basically just some moving pictures. I like to think of it that way. I think this is too low, so I'm going to have to. You can always find her in the group of beautiful thugs and too fast girls congregating on the corner and humming the latest rag, or lingering in front of Wanamaker's and gazing lustfully at a pair of fine shoes displayed like jewels behind the plate glass window. Watch her in the alley passing a pitcher of beer back and forth with her friends, brash and lovely in a cut-rate dress and silk ribbons. Look in awe as she hangs halfway out of a tenement window, taking in the drama of the block and defying gravity's downward pull. Step onto any of the paths that cross the sprawling city and you'll encounter her as she roams. Outsiders call the streets and alleys that comprise her world the slum. For her, it is just the place where she stays. You'd never happen onto her block unless you lived there too, or had lost your way, or were bored and out on an evening lark seeking the pleasures yielded by the other half. The voyeurs on their slumming expeditions feed on the lifeblood of the ghetto, long for it and loathe it. The social scientists and the reformers are no better, with their cameras and their surveys, gazing intently at all the strange specimens. Her ward of the city is a labyrinth of foul alleys and gloomy courts. It is Africa Town, the Negro Quarter, the Native Zone. It is a world concealed behind the facade of the ordered metropolis. The not yet dilapidated buildings and decent homes that face the street hide the alley tenement where she lives. Entering the narrow passageway into the alley, One crosses the threshold into a raucous, disorderly world, a place defined by tumult, vulgar collectivism, and anarchy. It is a human sewer populated by the worst elements. It is a realm of excess and fabulousness. It is a wretched environment. It is the settle and the plantation displaced in the city. It is a social laboratory where the sons and daughters of the rich come in search of meaning, vitality, and pleasure. It is a space of encounter between intellectuals, artists, reformers, and the truly disadvantaged, who are never seen as thinkers or planners, yet who create beautiful experiments of their own design. It is an urban commons where the poor assemble, improvise the forms of social existence, and refuse the menial life scripted for them. It is a zone of extreme deprivation and extravagant waste, where the decent reside with the dissolute and the immoral. It is a place bereft of beauty and immoderate in its display of it. Moving in and moving on established the rhythms of everyday life. Each wave of newcomers changed the slum, how it looks and sounds and smells. No one ever settles here, only stays, waits for better, and passes through. At least that is the hope. The slum is not yet the dark ghetto, but soon only the black folks will remain. Everything is in short supply except sensation. It is too much. The terrible beauty is more than one could ever hope to assimilate, order, and explain. The reformers snap their pictures of the buildings, the kitchenettes, and the outhouses. She notices as she watches from the third floor window of the alley house where she stays, laughing at their stupidity. They take a picture of Lombard Street during the few hours when hardly no one is there. She wonders what fascinates them about the clothesline and the privies. They always take pictures of the same stuff. Are the undergarments of the rich so much better? Is cotton so different than silk and not as pretty when draped like a banner across the streets? The race leaders and the uplifters fail to capture it, to get it right. All they see is a typical Negro alley, blind to the relay of looks and the pangs of desire that unsettle their captions and hint at the possibility of an existence bigger than squalor, at the tumult and upheaval that can't be arrested by the camera, at the forms of life that exceed the frame. They fail to discern the beauty and see only disorder, missing all the way she creates life and makes bare need into an arena of elaboration. The journalists from the Atlantic Monthly gush in print, quote, above the Jews in the same tenement houses, amid scenes of indescribable squalor and tawdry finery, dwell the Negroes, leading their lighthearted lives of pleasure, confusion, music, noise, and fierce fights that makes them a terror to white neighbors and landlords alike. Aroused at the sight of poor colored folks elegantly clad and preening on the corner, and disgusted at the aesthetical Negroes content to waste money on extravagance, ornament, and shine, the sociologist urges them to learn the value of a dollar from their Jewish and Italian neighbors. Negroes must abandon their lax moral habits, sensual indulgence, and wasteful excess. The present past of slavery unfolds in the street, and the home, which was broken completely by the slave ship and the promiscuous herding of the plantation, is now broken again, a home broken open in its embrace of strangers. A half-dressed woman wearing a house coat over a silk nightgown leans against the doorway, hidden by the shadows of the foyer, as she gossips with her girlfriend standing at the threshold. The senses are solicited and overwhelmed. Look over here, let your eyes take it all in. The sharpers lining the courtyard like sentinels, the extravagance of three lovely flower pots arranged on the sill of a tenement window, the bed sheets, monogrammed handkerchiefs, barber towels, and whores undergarments suspended on a line across the alley, broadcasting intimate matters. Women with packages tied in paper and string flip by like shadows. The harsh light falling behind them transforms them into silhouettes. The abstracted dark forms take the place of who they really are. The rag seller's daughters idle on the steps that descend to their cellar flat. The eldest is resplendent, sitting amidst the debris in her Sunday hat and soiled frock. The sun pours down the stairwell, pressing against the back of the girls and illuminating the entrance to the small, dank room, which is filled with the father's wares. Rags, papers, cast off, piecework, and discarded objects salvaged for future use, waste repurposed for survival. What you can hear if you listen, the guttural tones of Yiddish making English into a foreign tongue, the round, open-mouthed sounds of North Carolina and Virginia bleeding into the hard-edged language of the city and transformed by the rhythm and cadence of northern streets, the eruption of laughter, the volley of curses, the shouts make tenement walls vibrate and jar the floor, the sweet music of an extended moan that hushes the ones listening, eavesdroppers wanting more despite knowing they shouldn't, the rush of impressions, the musky odor of tightly pressed bodies dancing in a basement saloon, the inadvertent brush of a stranger's hand against yours as she moves across the courtyard, a glimpse of young lovers huddled in the deep shadows of a tenement hallway, the violent embrace of two men brawling, the acrid odor of bacon and hoe cake frying on an open fire, the honeysuckle of a domestic's toilet water, the maple smoke rising from an old man's corncob pipe. A whole world is jammed into one short block, crowded with black folks shut out from almost every opportunity the city affords, but still intoxicated with freedom. The air is alive with the possibilities of assembling, gathering, congregating. At any moment, the promise of insurrection, the miracle of upheaval, small groups, people by themselves and strangers threaten to become an ensemble to incite treason en masse. There are no visible signs on shop doors barring her entrance, and she could sit anywhere she wanted on streetcars and in theaters, even if people inched away as if she were contagious when she chose the seat next to them, and she could go to the minstrel show or the Nickelodeon on the same day the white folks did, although it was more fun and she breathed easier when it was just colored and she knew she wouldn't be insulted. Despite the liberties of the city, there is no better life here than in Virginia, no brighter future to grow into, no opportunities for colored girls besides the broom and the mop or spread eagle in really hard times. Everything essential, where she goes to school, the kind of job she can get, where she can live, is dictated by the color line, which places her on the bottom and everybody else on top. Being young, she tries to dream another life into existence, one in which her horizon isn't limited to the maid's uniform and her only prospect isn't a white woman's dirty house. In this other life, she would not be required to take all the shit that no one else would accept and pretend to be grateful. In this city of brotherly love, she has been confined to a squalid zone that no one else would suffer. It isn't the cradle of liberty or the free territory or even a temporary refuge, but a place where an Irish mob beat her uncle nearly to death for trying to vote, where the police dragged her to jail for hanging out in the streets with her friends. In the North, white folks made your blood run cold, not because they would hang you from a tree, but because their eyes communicated what their hearts felt. Hate could shatter you in a thousand pieces, make you feel your existence was a crime. At Second and Bainbridge, she heard a white man shout, lynch him, after a colored man accused of stealing a loaf of bread from the corner grocer ran past. At 41st Street and 8th Avenue, the policeman yelled, black bitch, come out now. He dragged her out in her nightgown and then beat her to a pulp and arrested her for resisting. When Paul Lawrence Dunbar spotted her on 7th Avenue, he feared for American civilization. Looking at the girl amidst the crowd of idle, striking Negroes who filled the street, he wondered, what is to be done with them? What is to be done for them if they are to be prevented from inoculating our civilization with the poison of their lives? They are not anarchists, and yet in these seemingly careless crowds lies a terrible menace to our institutions. Though she had not read God in the State or What is Property or The Conquest of Bread, she refused to be governed. She was the kind of girl who smashed things up and made even the socialists afraid. She longed for a new set of arrangements without rulers and masters and states. She was arrested as a vagrant for trying to merely subsist, to live a beautiful life on nothing at all, to hustle, to scrape by. Hers was a struggle that left behind no manifestos or tracks. Thought was articulated in deed and act, and every act engendered criminality and encouraged open rebellion. Dunbar lamented, if only she and others like her could be prevented from flocking to the city, if the metropolis could vomit them back to the south, then the whole matter would adjust. Better for them and for us the restrictions of the south than a seeming liberty which blossoms noxiously into license. Better the fields and the shotgun houses and the dusty rooms and the interminable cycle of credit and debt. Better this than black anarchy. Most days, the assault of the city threatened to break her. When the water in the only spigot for the entire block had stopped running, when even in her best dress, she could not help but wonder if she smelled like the outhouse, when she was so hungry that the aroma of bean soup wafting from the settlement kitchen made her mouth water, she took to the streets as if in search of the real city and not this poor imitation. The old ladies perched in their window shouted, "Girl, where you headed?" Each new deprivation raised questions about when freedom was going to come. If the tally of things gained and lost between 1865 and 1900 leveled out in the end, if the question pounding inside her head, "Can I live?" was one to which she could ever give a certain answer, but only repeat in anticipation of something better than this, bear the pain of it and the hope of it, the beauty and the promise.